At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Democrats want them. Republicans want them. Nobody's got them, though. New ones. Anyway, jobs on the program today. From American Public Media. Yeah, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Allianz, providing investment, insurance, and retirement solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S. since 1896. AllianzUSA.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 16th of August today. That 9% unemployment rate, 9.2% to be exact, you suppose that could be it, as low as it gets? And if it is, then what do we do? That's our coverage on The Breakdown today, our economy one step at a time. Before we get there, though, there is the news of the day to digest. French President Nicolas Sarkozy and German Chancellor Angela Merkel had a little tête-à-tête in Paris today. Yet another session about how to rein in the European debt crisis. And, not just for the heck of it, how to get the Eurozone growing again. We learned today that the German economy, the continent's biggest, came to a screeching halt last quarter. From London, Christopher Wirth reports.
Germany is Europe's biggest economy, but how big?
It's pretty big.
Hendrik Koenig is with Metzler Equity Research in Frankfurt.
The German economy accounts for around 25% of the Eurozone GDP.
Until now, Germany has been the powerhouse of economic recovery among the 17 countries in the Eurozone. But in the last quarter, domestic consumption fell. Energy production slumped after the government decided to shut down 8 nuclear power plants. And imports have risen faster than exports. Karsten Brzeski, an economist at ING in Brussels, says this is not good news.
With the slowdown now, it really shows that even the power engine is losing steam.
And he says that could have implications for how Europe manages its current debt crisis. As Europe's largest economy, Germany has coughed up the bulk of the money used to bail out Greece, Ireland, and Portugal. But who will ride to the rescue if a slowing economy means Germany can no longer go on footing the bill? And how long will the patience of Germany's taxpayers last?
If people start to actually feel it in their pockets, then I think that support from the German public for more German taxpayers' money to other countries will weaken.
However, he says these slower growth figures are more a return to earth from higher growth figures in Germany over the past couple of years, and not the return of recession. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
This is day two of President Obama's bus tour through the Midwest, mostly standard fare so far. He's held town hall meetings. He's met with small business owners. He's unveiled new programs, specifically those promoting job growth in rural parts of the country. $200 million in all, introducing small business owners to venture capitalists, helping small hospitals recruit new doctors, that kind of thing. $200 million isn't much in this sized economy, so we sent David Gura off this morning to find out how much difference a small investment like that can really make.
Iowa's got a lot of big warehouses. It's home to trucking companies. And those businesses are doing pretty well in the Hawkeye State.
It has nothing to do with any particular investment on the part of the federal government, unless it's that we have to make sure that we have, you know, roads that don't have lots of potholes in them.
Peter Erasm teaches economics at Iowa State University. He says the freight business is booming because of where Iowa is.
At the end of the day, the types of jobs that will be sustainable in any area depends on the comparative advantage of that area.
Erasm's not sure this investment, targeted at just a few sectors, will do much for employment nationwide.
There's not a whole lot of evidence that investing in particular businesses have been particularly successful. The government hasn't been that good at picking winners and losers.
James Galbraith is also skeptical. He's an economist at the University of Texas. He says there are steps the government can take to make sure taxpayer dollars aren't wasted. He says it should never go to fields that require expensive equipment.
In general, the more labor-intensive the activity, the more service-oriented the activity, the more jobs you get.
And Galbraith says it's important to keep tabs on where that money ends up. UC Berkeley economist Sylvia Allegretto doesn't think the president's plan is big enough. She says the scale's just too small.
We have a jobs deficit that is massive, and this is going to do very little in the short run to fill in that jobs gap.
With millions of Americans unemployed, maybe fixing potholes would put more of them back to work. But Obama can't do that by himself. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The corporate story of the day today comes to us via Bentonville, Arkansas. Walmart announced quarterly profits that beat expectations this morning. On the face of it, good news, but one can only rarely take corporate earnings reports at face value. Most of that growth that Walmart had from the developing world. Back here at home, a decline in sales at existing stores. A decline, by the way, not all of which, to bury the lead a bit, is because of a weak economy. Marketplace's Eve Troe has that story.
Walmart's seen weak domestic sales for more than 2 years now. It blames everything you'd expect a company to blame during a recession. In today's earnings call, Walmart CEO Mike Duke said people are most worried about jobs and food prices.
They're trading down to stretch their budgets, buying a lower-priced brand of detergent, and purchasing half gallons of milk instead of gallons.
That's what Walmart's own consumer focus groups say. They also say gas prices have taken a back seat, so customers don't mind driving to Walmart more often. But the economy is not the only thing driving sales, says Bud Bugatch with investment firm Raymond James.
Some of the problems that it's encountered have been of its own making.
He says Walmart streamlined its inventory and cut some products people really liked. Plus, Walmart needs to do better reminding people why they shop there.
Going back and re-emphasizing its everyday low price.
Walmart has been putting items back on the shelves, lowering prices, and telling people about it. And that's why U.S. sales, while still slow, have been stronger the past few months. But Bert Flickinger at Strategic Resource Group says 2 years of weak sales show the company's lost its edge.
In the prior six recessions, the worst economic times were the best of times for Walmart.
He says Target, Kroger, Costco, and CVS have managed to grow, so Walmart's getting squeezed by competition. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Traders on Wall Street today had one eye on Europe, the other on the bond market. We'll have the details when we do the numbers.
I finished my PhD a year ago. The job market for geographers in particular is non-existent.
My friend's a single mom, and she has been unemployed and is talking about going on food stamps.
Dominic Korva from Seattle, Washington. Pam Victor from Pelham, Massachusetts, in the bridge right there. Seems to me if we're going to talk a lot about jobs today, and we are, we would do well to set the stage a bit. So here you go. 13.9 million people are unemployed in this country. About half of them have been looking for work for more than a year. 8.5 million people are part-timers, not by choice either. They would rather work more but can't get the hours. 3 million are what the Bureau of Labor Statistics calls marginally attached. They want to work. They're available to work. They can't find anything. And about half of that group has just stopped looking altogether. And finally, that's only the folks who are on the record with the official census. Marketplace's Scott Tong has spent some time this year looking at the future of jobs. Hey, Scott.
Hello, Kai.
So, Scott, remind us how big is the jobs hole and you know, what does it look like?
Well, it looks a little like the number 12, and here's what that means. By one measure, we need to create 12 million jobs in the U.S. economy to get back to pre-recession levels. And at a pace of about 200,000 new jobs per month, which is actually pretty good compared to what we've seen, it would take 12 years. So call it whatever you want. It's quite a hole. But here's what economists call the structural thing here. The jobs of tomorrow that we're hopefully going to create will probably not look like yesterday's jobs. A lot of labor economists say we've lost jobs in the middle, that is, that require middle skills, say you have a high school education but maybe not a full college degree, and they command middle wages. Economist David Otter over at MIT studies jobs that involve a lot of what he calls routine. You attach a windshield on a car in a factory over and over again. You're a bank teller. You're a typist. Those jobs, he says, are gone for good.
It raises the possibility that there will be missing rungs in the career ladder, if you will. If you think about good blue-collar production jobs or office administrative support jobs, those were often career occupations. They were things that offered stability and certainly a sustainable standard of living.
Well, let me ask you this, though, Scott, and it's basically, you know, technology replacing people instead of lower-wage workers overseas, and I get that. But the big question this week is, how did we get here? What happened that made this change come?
Well, this is a long story. I mean, technology giveth, technology taketh away. It goes all the way back at least 200 years to England when mechanical looms threatened human weavers. And we all get 10 points for remembering those are the Luddites. And in the American South, right, technology and railroads and electricity took good jobs from the Northeast, the expensive Northeast, to the cheaper South. Today, of course, we have the internet technology, which challenges the old school middlemen and the salesmen, of course. Many say the big change began in the 91 recession, when lots of these routine jobs in the middle didn't come back when the economy came back. And now this is looking like the third straight recession that looks like that.
So here's the question for the next year in American politics. Where does job growth come from? How do you do that?
Labor economists look at what they see now, and they see growth at the top as doctors, software writers, petroleum engineers, and a lot of them at the bottom, home health care aides, dog walkers, people who mow lawns, the bottom of the income scale. And there are a lot of people, of course, who are chasing those jobs, so those wages aren't going to go up very quickly. I mean, we risk oversimplifying, but a lot of people describe it as an hourglass economy, and that's going to be what it kind of looks like for a while.
What do you do then, Scott?
Well, this is where we collide into politics. Many say we invest in education because there's a lot of numbers that say a bachelor's degree translates into a big and increasing wage premium is what they call it. A lot of countries are investing public dollars into new sectors where they hope a lot of these jobs in the middle are. Biotech, clean tech, infrastructure to shore up some of these jobs and create new ones going forward.
Ambitious government programs at a time when government is getting less ambitious.
Well, and that's the question. There are a lot of programs, a lot of tax incentives that try to create these things, but we're in a budget environment where, you know, those tend not to be on the table. So tough calls going forward.
Scott Tong on the jobs picture for us. Scott, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
I have a lot of friends across all industries, from tech to labor, that have fallen into unemployment, and all we can do is laugh it off and say we're all in the same boat.
Bill Jones there, out of Seattle, Washington. The problem with official government economic numbers is that the American economy is so big, there's an inherent degree of uncertainty in any given measurement. That 9.2% unemployment rate is as good an example as any, fine as a national average, but there are plenty of places where it's a lot higher. And again, as I said before, that's just officially. Millions of people have dropped out of the workforce altogether over the past couple of years. Marketplace's Amy Scott spent some time in just such a place.
One thing Baltimore still has going for it is its public markets, where stalls sell fresh produce, meat, and fish. At Northeast Market in East Baltimore, I found Dwayne Robertson eating clams off the shell with horseradish and a splash of hot sauce.
Yeah, I like hot spicy stuff.
Robertson's 48. He supports a three-year-old daughter with unemployment checks and odd jobs. Lives with his sister. He lost his job as a maintenance worker almost a year ago.
Online, I may have like 200-300 applications. In the street, I may have about 75. And out of all the applications I put in, I may have had 4 interviews.
In this part of town, unemployment is well over 20%. But most people older than 16 aren't even in the workforce.
Everybody is basically unemployed, especially most of the males. There's no work for them. We have a lot of programs, like job readiness programs, but they're not helping them find jobs because I've been through maybe 3 of those and still I'm unemployed.
Lucinda Brown has a job in a supermarket part-time, making $7.50 an hour. But like a lot of people here, she never really noticed the recovery. Have you seen any improvement in the economy over the last couple years?
Not one bit, not one bit. It's still the same, and if it ain't the same, it's getting worse.
Brown is 27, a single mom supporting two kids. She'd love to move to a better neighborhood, but can't afford to.
The crime rate goes up. Theft is basically the highest. I done seen somebody snatch money from an old lady and took off. So it's bad.
Do you feel safe with your kids here?
No, I don't feel safe at all. That's why I stay in the house unless I'm going to work.
You feel safe at work?
No.
East Baltimore is struggling, not from the latest recession, but from decades of losing population and jobs.
When you're talking about, you know, urban distressed neighborhoods, you're talking about areas that are only marginally attached to the national economy, so they can't get much worse than 20% unemployment.
Richard Clinch is director of economic research at the University of Baltimore's Jacob France Institute. He says what the recession did was halt some of the recovery that was underway here.
And should we go into a double dip, which is looking somewhat likely now, you know, you can see, you know, development activities that were starting to restart in some of these communities stop.
So what does long-term unemployment look like? Block after block of boarded-up buildings, crime, drugs, failing schools.
You ever look down the street and you see them open lots? This whole area is just going to crumble until somebody says, okay, we got some jobs available. Let's get back to work.
Harry Bennett is out of work. He's eating lake trout, a Baltimore specialty. Bennett is an engineer trained to build computers, but his last job was selling paint at Home Depot. He's 65 and finally started drawing Social Security after his unemployment benefits ran out.
That's the only income that I have right now. I mean, I feel like I've been robbed because I have a lot of knowledge. I cannot use it, and I can't give it away because nobody wants it.
And it'll take a much stronger national recovery to put people like Bennett back to work. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
I've felt it at various points during the past couple years, but I've been okay.
You know, I mean, I used to make $32,000 a year. Now when you're maintaining less than $5,000 a year, big difference.
Maria Lamanto from New York City, Mark Lusseau from Des Moines, Iowa. Coming up, jobs for the future.
Kind of the vibe in Nebraska is a sense of realistic hopefulness.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials fell 0.2% on this Tuesday, 76 points, closed at 11,405 did the blue chips. The NASDAQ down 1.25%, 31 points, 25.23 at the bell. The S&P 500 slipped 1%, 11 points, finished at 11.92. Banks gave back a lot of the ground they gained yesterday. Citigroup withdrew 4.25%. Bank of America slumped 4.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase unrolled 2.33%. Big box retailers jumped on those numbers from Wall Street that we mentioned earlier. Walmart charged up nearly 4%. Costco rang up more than 1%. Target shot up 2.5% today. Home Depot nailed a 5% gain. Pandora spun up nearly 4% after it announced a new version of its online platform. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.22%. Neatly symmetrical, I think. You're listening to Marketplace.
Every 2 weeks, Freakonomics brings something special to Marketplace.
You sent me $5, man.
Wasn't that nice of me? Yeah.
That was nice. Should I open this?
If you dare, open it.
Oh, I hate you.
Join us as we unwrap little surprises. You'll be all the richer.
I kept the $5, by the way, from the lottery thing. I kept it.
I've noticed.
All right.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Reputation.com, protecting online privacy by removing your personal data from the internet and stopping unwanted email. Reputation.com. Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on mileage and safe driving habits. Learn more at Progressive.com. Marketplace Innovation Reporting is supported by the 2011 Jaguar XJ. Learn more at a local dealer or at jaguarusa.com. Every every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Labor Department issues the Producer Price Index for July. Look, Ma, no hands. The Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International continues a symposium in Washington. And Goodfellow Robert De Niro turns 68. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media is another way to say that. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We started today with Europe and its debt problem. We'll get the second half of the broadcast rolling with Europe and its jobs problem. Bad as it's been here, long-term unemployment's been a much bigger issue in Europe. More people out of work for more time, depending, that is, on where you live. From the European desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
No one visiting Retiro Park in central Madrid in Spain would think the Europeans could teach the US anything about curbing unemployment. The park is full of young, jobless men. In this country, 43% of the under-30s are unemployed. And after 2 or 3 years out of work, some, like Diego Hernandez and Omid Mossani, are losing hope.
We can't dream, you know, about the house, about many things. Not about buy a car or something like that.
Right now it's really, really, really difficult to find a job here. And I go every day. I go out from my house. I go to every many places to ask about job, but no, nothing.
But Spain is Europe's worst employment black spot. Germany, Britain, all of Scandinavia and the Netherlands are doing somewhat better than the US. The reason, says David Grubb of the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, comes down to unemployment pay. He says America's decision to extend the benefit period from 26 to 99 weeks helps to account for the US's stubbornly high unemployment rate.
Many European countries have experienced this, that when benefit systems are increased, benefits are made more generous. In various different ways, unemployment goes up.
It goes up, he says, because the unemployed have less incentive to get back to work as soon as possible. John Philpott is with the Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development in London.
I think there are lessons for the US to learn in terms of benefits and labour market programme policies.
Philpott says that what matters are the conditions attached to the benefits. Some European countries, Germany, the Netherlands and others, offer much more generous unemployment pay than the US and for longer. But they have a lower unemployment rate because they constantly pester and cajole and, if necessary, retrain the unemployed back into jobs.
The Danes also invest a lot in jobs programs in order to, sort of make sure that people are helped back into work. It's called, in the European jargon, it's called flexicurity.
There is an irony here. Throughout the last decade, the US lectured Europe on the merits of deregulation and labour market flexibility. The motto was, if it's easier to fire, it will be easier to hire. But that's now backfired on American workers and also explains America's high unemployment. Ian Brinkley of the Work Foundation.
American employers shed labour very rapidly and very quickly. In Germany and the UK, they didn't. They held on to labour much more than we would have thought they would have done, given the severity of the downturn.
Of course, when the US economy bounces back, US business will no doubt be snapping up workers again, and there'll be much less need for jobs programmes and other such European-style initiatives. But the bounce back doesn't seem imminent, and the longer people are jobless, the harder it is to get them back to work, as the Europeans, and especially the Spanish, know only too well. At the European desk in London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Well, I have a son who has been unemployed for a while now, and I've told him you need to go back to school and finish your degree. I think it's made a lot of people think about that, you know, taking a different route, retraining for jobs.
Jill Foster from Atlanta, Georgia, right there. Our coverage of jobs today has been mostly of those already in the labor force and looking for work. Max Rodenberg is on the near end of that timeline, 20 years old, about to start his junior year at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, studying business and Spanish, as it happens. Max, good to talk to you.
Hey, thank you. Good to be on.
What kind of work experience do you have at the ripe old age of 20?
I guess my first big boy job, I guess you could call it, was I worked at a Pinnacle Bank here in Lincoln, and I was sort of an office assistant. I had that when I was a senior in high school. And then when I was a freshman, I got an internship with Northwestern Mutual Financial Network. And this summer, I obtained my Nebraska real estate license. And for the last little over a month, I've been a licensed realtor with Nebraska Home Sales here in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Has nobody told you that this is a really bad time to be in real estate?
Well, you know, actually, we've been pretty fortunate in Nebraska. We didn't get to experience the dramatic appreciation that places such as, you know, Miami and Arizona and California did. But then we got kind of lucky because we were cushioned when the bubble burst and everything was sort of spiraling downward. We've gone down about 4% a year.
So you're a junior this year. You've got two more years to figure it out. So this might be a premature question, but when you get out of school, what's the choice going to be? Are you going to get a job, or are you going to do what a lot of people are doing in the economy nowadays since they can't get jobs? And are you going to go to grad school?
I still haven't decided completely. I know I do want to go to grad school, but the decision to either go to grad school right after college or work for a couple of years and then go back, that's still kind of up in the air. But it's kind of great with this real estate thing is I can do both. Mm-hmm. I've been taking classes in the morning, and then I can work all afternoon and whatnot, and I've always liked being busy.
What's the vibe, though, amongst you and your friends about prospects? I mean, you know, when I was a junior in college, I didn't talk much about jobs, but, you know, the economy was a whole lot better back then.
Right. Right now, the vibe I kind of get from my buddies that are graduating, a lot of them are just taking what they can get. I haven't witnessed anybody not be able to get a job at all, but I'm sure I know a few people that I could tell you they wish they could have found something a little bit better, a little bit higher paying. But I've also got a couple of friends who I've got one that's working on Wall Street right out of college. He got a signing bonus with his job. And I've got another one that's got a very good job at ConAgra right outside of college. So I'd say the vibe in Nebraska is a sense of realistic hopefulness. They're hoping that they can get that job they've always dreamed of, but they've got that realistic side that they're thinking about too.
Max Rodenberg, he's going to be a junior at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. School starts Monday. Max, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation, supporting customer choice and clean, efficient energy sources and technologies, working with customers nationwide to create a sustainable energy future. Constellation.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, you might have heard or seen this tape already. Texas Governor Rick Perry last night speaking about Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States, and how the governor, also a presidential candidate, doesn't much care for the Fed's current position on monetary policy.
I mean, printing more money to play politics at this particular time in American history is almost treasonous, in my opinion.
It's worth a note, should one care to check, that Mr. Bernanke was appointed by a Republican president, and also that the penalty for treason in this country is death. That's it. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 76 points, about 2/3 of 1%. The NASDAQ fell 31 points, 1.25%. The S&P 500 gave back 11 points, 1%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. You can get the latest installment of The Breakdown, Our Economy One Step at a Time, tomorrow on The Morning Show. Coming up next time back here.
If we don't have the feeder businesses that are basically the fuel to our economy, that's a problem.
An economy's got to start somewhere, you know. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us. for that tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.